Hey, it's Glenn Washington, the host of the Snap Judgment Podcast. And at Snap, each and every week, we drop you into someone else's world. Feel what they feel. Duck when they duck. Weep when they weep. And laugh when they laugh. Surprising, cinematic, it's raw. Stories that connect us all. We go there each and every week because we found that it is hard to hate someone if you know their story. Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat. Each and every week, listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Looking for a more affordable way to own in 2026? With shared ownership at Latimer Homes, you can reserve your new home for just £26 before the 26th January. Lower upfront costs, modern, stylish homes, and a clearer path onto the property ladder, making it easier than ever to step into home ownership. Find out more at latimerhomes.com. T's and C's apply.
Hey y'all, Mario from Borderly here. And before getting into our second episode and our conversation with Bob Moore, president and founder of El Paso Matters, I just wanted to give a quick content warning before the beginning of the episode. We talked to Bob at length about his career covering the El Paso Juarez region as a journalist, but towards the back half of the conversation, we do focus on the El Paso shooting of 2019. We don't go into any graphic details, but of course there are mentions of murder, gun violence, and hate crimes. So just take care while listening. Thank you so much, and enjoy the episode. There are days in a city's history that create a before and an after. Moments when an ordinary morning becomes something a community carries for generations. For those of us who grew up in El Paso or who have spent any amount of time in El Paso, one of those days is certainly August 3rd, 2019.
That breaking news out of El Paso, where the site of a deadly shooting inside a shopping center continues to develop. Police in El Paso say 20 people are dead and 26 more were wounded.
It was a summer Saturday, family shopping, and much like many people still do to this day, people were crossing in from Mexico to run their weekly errands. Nothing was unusual, nothing remarkable. And then, a gunman, driven by racist ideology, hatred in his heart, and a gun in his hand, walked into a Walmart, one that I had shopped at many times growing up in El Paso, and opened fire on Mexicans and Mexican Americans, or anyone who he deemed not worthy of being in the U.S. 23 lives were taken that day. Some of them were Mexican citizens, but mostly it was U.S. citizens who were victims. Dozens more were wounded, and an entire community was shaken in a way that still shapes our sense of safety, belonging, and identity. I think for me, living in Austin at the time and seeing reports on social media and texts from friends, I immediately thought of my friends and my family to ensure that they were safe, not fully understanding the context of what had happened or the severity of the attack. But even thinking to myself at that time, rightly or wrongly, that there was no way that it could have been someone from El Paso who did this. But not even a couple of hours after the shooting began, there were reports of a manifesto that were using words like invasion, targeting Hispanics, targeting essentially people who looked like me or who looked like my parents. And the shooter had driven 10 hours to make his point. So I think it's certainly a day that not only shapes the history of the city itself, but those of us who hold the city close to our hearts. This is Mario Carrillo with Borderly, a project of Immigrantly. In our our first episode, we spoke to Dr. Yolanda Chavez Leyva, who reminded us that the border is a place with a long memory, a place where history must be actively preserved because so much of it is vulnerable to being forgotten, distorted, or erased. She talked about the responsibility of documenting the past and not letting others define it for us. But after August 3rd, 2019, that responsibility moved into the present tense. Because before the national outlets arrived to cover the attack, before the headlines framed exactly what had happened here, it was El Paso's own journalists who began keeping that record. Reporters who live here. Reporters who understood the victims not as characters in a breaking news cycle, but as neighbors and community members. Reporters who carried the emotional weight of telling the world what had been done to our community and ensuring that the full story was told even long after national reporters had left. Among them was Bob Moore, founder and CEO of El Paso Matters, an independent journalism project that covers our border region in both English and in Spanish. His coverage of the shooting and its aftermath, its human toll, its political context, its meaning for the border, would later make him a Pulitzer Prize finalist. But the recognition is not the point. The point is that his reporting, alongside so many local journalists, helped El Paso understand itself in the days that followed. It helped ensure that what had happened to us would be documented with accuracy, dignity, and care. If our first Borderly episode was about the long memory of the border, today's episode is about the people who protect that memory in real time. And what makes Bob's story especially compelling to me is that he didn't grow up here. He didn't inherit this community's history. He learned it slowly, humbly, through decades of reporting, listening, and realizing that the border refuses to be reduced to a headline. So before we talk about immigration, or before we talk about August 3rd, 2019, before we even talk about the founding of El Paso Matters, I want to start at the beginning of Bob's story on the border. Okay, Bob, thank you so much for joining us. I'd like to start our interview a bit on your own background, on your own story, and how you ended up in El Paso. I know that you're not originally from here. What was it that brought you to El Paso in the first place? And what were your preconceptions of both El Paso and more broadly the border region before having actually moved here?
Yeah, so first it's probably important to note that I'm the son of a career Air Force non-commissioned officer. My parents were from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but my dad joined the Air Force and kind of raised a family all over the United States. And the longest I ever lived in one place as a child was in Japan for 4 years. So kind of lived all over the country. My father had his last assignment in the Air Force in Colorado Springs. So that's where I went to high school. I went to college at a small state school in Pueblo called the University of Southern Colorado then. It's now Colorado State University at Pueblo. I can say without fear of contradiction that I was among the worst students to ever go through that institution. I managed to get myself asked to leave an open enrollment school, which is not an easy thing to do. But I was on the debate team in college while I was there, and that kind of took up a lot of my energy and shaped who I am. One side note that the folks from the border might find funny. One of my debate rivals when I was in college was a young Air Force Academy cadet named Heather Wilson, who's now the president of the University of Texas at El Paso. So 45 years later, we both wind up finding ourselves in the same community.
What a small world, Bob. That's wild.
It is a small world. That may be a large extracurricular activity in college. Maybe that explains part of it. When I was asked to take some time off from college, I got a job at the weekly newspaper in my hometown in suburban Colorado Springs, worked there for 6 months, and then got hired at one of the two daily newspapers in Colorado Springs, which promptly closed 2 years later. And that's kind of how I wound up in El Paso. The El Paso Times, which was one of two newspapers at the time in El Paso, was the first place to offer me a job. I wasn't sure there'd be a second place, so I took it. And I had some familiarity with El Paso thanks to my debating experience in college. We'd come down here 2 years in a row in 1979 and 1980 for debate tournaments at UTEP and El Paso Community College. I got my first exposure to Juarez in those trips, college student.
That must have been fun, yeah.
you can imagine that was probably the more memorable experience. You know, the one thing about Pueblo, where I went to school, that was, they didn't use the phrase then, but it was a Hispanic serving institution. It was maybe not a majority Hispanic institution, but it was predominantly Hispanic. So I was familiar with Hispanic culture. That wasn't new to me. But border culture, fronterizo culture, was very new to me. It was quite an eye-opener.
I would love to know if, especially early on, to what extent was there a moment or a story that you were working on as you were still relatively new to El Paso that maybe shaped your understanding early on during your time on the border, or if there are any specific memories that you can recall and thinking, wow, okay, this is a little bit different.
When I first started, my job at the El Paso Times was, I was the night city editor. And so this is in the spring and summer of 1986, and you had the beginnings of true democracy in Mexico at that point. The National Action Party, or PAN, had made some inroads in Chihuahua, and there was a big governor's race that year, and there was a lot of concerns that the PRI would interfere with the election, which they undoubtedly did. And so for a period of time, over several weeks, like every Sunday, PAN activists would block one or more of the international bridges linking El Paso and Juarez. And of course, I knew nothing about Mexican politics. And I also learned really, really quickly how important those bridges were to economic activity and cultural activity and just families staying in touch with each other. So that was a big learning experience. My coworkers started calling me Blockade Bob because these activities had never happened until I showed up. And then for some reason, they only happened on Sundays, which was the one day of the week that El Paso Times allowed me to be in charge of the newspaper. So that was a very quick introduction into the nature of the border and how connected these two communities were, and how disrupting the connection between those two communities was a great way to make a political point.
Right. That's incredible. So you got an early on glimpse of what life was like on the border for those of us who grew up on it. I think for me, especially having grown up here in the mid-90s, being a kid and crossing the border freely, it was such a different experience to what it is now and has been not now for like the last 24 years since 9/11. So I'm glad you got that experience of what the community was like back then, because I feel like it's changed so much over the last couple of decades. I'm curious what those early beats were that you were focusing on El Paso, because I feel like, and correct me, but maybe nationally, El Paso wasn't as widely known maybe as it is now for various reasons. So what was that national perception that you were maybe having to navigate against, especially in a very different media landscape at that point?
Yeah, El Paso was obviously a much smaller city than it is now. Immigration politics were a lot different. And as you mentioned, the border was very open. We used to wrap up the paper at midnight or so, walk across the bridge, go shoot some pool in Juarez, have a couple of beers, and then come back. And it was a really easy thing to do, because the border security wasn't there. And I always remember one of the first things that caught my attention in El Paso was watching these guys with inner tubes pulling people across the river to come to the United States, like right under the bridge. And there's no border patrol to intercept them or anything. So the politics that El Paso sort of became the focal point of 20 or 30 years later just didn't exist there. So there wasn't a whole lot of national media attention in El Paso. When we did get it, it would tend to be around Fort Bliss. I remember a lot of national media attention descending on the city for the first Gulf War in 1991. But other than that, and other than the occasional, strange story that might catch some attention, there really wasn't a lot of national attention paid to El Paso. So a lot of my time, especially in the late 80s and early 90s, was focusing on politics, local government, education. Also, I kind of started developing a passion for demography. So I really started diving into census numbers and other data to really kind of understand the nature of the community better. And that's something that has stuck with me for the last, I guess, 40 years. So next spring will be the 40th anniversary of my arrival in El Paso.
Oh, we got to celebrate that, Bob. That's incredible.
Yeah, I got to look up what the date was.
Oh, okay. Well, once you figure that out, we'll make sure we have a nice big party for you. On the topic of immigration in particular, I know that in the late 80s, early 90s, very different time, but I think it was in 1993, Operation Hold the Line, a major mobilization of Border Patrol agents began here after complaints at Bowie High School, that's right on the border for those who might not be familiar with the border region. This is a high school, one of the oldest ones in the city, that essentially just juts right up to the border. And if you're in the high school, you can essentially see the border wall from the high school there. So this is pre-border wall. This was pre the enforcement machine that we know today. But can you let folks know? I'm not sure to the extent that you covered it personally, but I'm sure you're very familiar with the history of it. But I kind of almost feel like that's the turning point for the city in terms of immigration enforcement and what began to change after that.
And for the nation as a whole. So it's important to note that at that point, the El Paso Border Patrol sector gets a new sector chief in named Sylvester Reyes, who is a local guy. He grew up in Canutillo. I remember even back then, the arrival of a new Border Patrol sector chief was kind of a big deal. And with Reyes being a hometown guy, it was even more important. But he had this idea that you just have at the border itself this free flow of people going back and forth without any enforcement. And much of the enforcement that took place with the Border Patrol, and it was a much smaller agency at that point, was essentially to lay back from the border and then chase people as they get into the community, which is not good for a lot of reasons. It's not good for neighborhoods. It's not good for immigrants. And it's not good for Border Patrol agents, too. A lot of people getting hurt, killed, or whatever. And it was really ineffective. So Reyes had this idea that he would position Border Patrol agents every quarter of a mile with their vehicles on the border. And basically, this is the beginning of the deterrence strategy. Rather than trying to catch people as they come in, you start to undertake efforts to stop them from coming in the first place. The operation was originally named Operation Blockade. I think Reyes named it that himself. Somebody pointed out at some point that under international law, blockade is an act of war. So probably not the best name. And so it was kind of quickly renamed Operation Hold the Line. And the Border Patrol studied what Reyes was doing and pretty quickly began to deploy that strategy, at least in the urban parts of the border. So that was really where you begin this strategy of deterrence. This is during the Clinton administration. And so Doris Meisner was the director of the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and she and some others began really shaping this deterrence concept as a means of judging the effectiveness of border security stuff. So you begin to have some barriers there. And interestingly, if you go back and look at Clinton administration documents, one of the measures of effectiveness that they would use to determine whether deterrence was effective was whether more people were dying during the crossing attempt because deploying very visible officers in urban areas forced people into more remote, more dangerous crossings. So a higher rate of deaths in crossing as a positive sign that our immigration policy was working. And I think that's something that a lot of Americans never really quite understood, that our enforcement policies, especially deterrence policies, have long been shaped by the idea of what the Border Patrol calls consequence delivery. And sometimes that means apprehension and detention, but other times it means falling and badly injuring yourself off of a 30-foot wall, or drowning in the river, or dying of heat stroke in the desert. So that's always been something that I thought should have been more centered in the conversation about our policy. If that's going to be our policy, let's make sure we understand it and talk about it. And by and large, we never have.
No, and I even remember listening to stories on certain folks in the Bowie area and the Bowie region expressing regret essentially for what had happened after the enforcement machine really started ramping up. Because you're right, I think what ended up happening was there was an acceptable amount of death that immigration enforcement was essentially okay with. That we know that our tactics are leading people to take paths that are significantly more dangerous through desert terrain without water. And we know that that's a price to pay, essentially, for having a perceived safer border. On Sylvester Reyes, as an aside, now that you brought him up, for those who might not be familiar with El Paso politics, he ended up becoming a member of Congress from 1997 all the way until 2013, when he was defeated in a primary by a scrappy upstart city councilor here in El Paso by Beto O'Rourke. But we can save the story on Beto for a later day.
I do think it's worth noting that his election was a reflection of how popular those policies were in El Paso at the time.
Right. And I feel like that's one of the things that maybe we can touch on as well, is like the ebb and flow, depending on the perceived amount of people that are trying to come into the country, especially people here along the border, how welcoming or maybe less so they become. Because I know that even in El Paso, during the Biden administration, the last 4 years, there ended up becoming, it became something of the narrative where El Paso understood that there was a crisis. And even though there were a lot of people, and you've spoken about this, willing to volunteer and to support, I think how the media portrayed it, even folks in El Paso ended up becoming less welcoming of the idea. So I feel like there's always been ebbs and flows in terms of how El Pasoans and other border residents perceive enforcement on the border.
Absolutely. And the one thing I'll say is, if you look at older neighborhoods in El Paso, in sort of the core urban areas, one of the features of many of those houses are wrought iron bars on the window. Those are not just decorative. They became a common feature in the 70s and 80s because El Paso had high burglary rates. And rightly or wrongly, a lot of people in El Paso associated that with sort of free border crossings, that it was easy for people to come over here, commit crimes, and then go back. I think that's an uncharitable view of our own homegrown criminals in El Paso. We had plenty of those who were quite able to do it. But I think one of the reasons that Hold the Line was popular in the early 90s in El Paso was because it got connected with the crime issue in El Paso. And by the way, that is also right at the point where El Paso's crime rate began a very rapid and continuing decline. I don't think it was because of tighter border enforcement. I think there's a lot of other demographic factors that came into that. But I mentioned that because this issue of security and the issue of chaos has an impact on people. If they don't feel secure, if they see a chaotic situation, people are more likely to hand more power to the government to do things. And I think that is sort of the history of immigration enforcement in this country.
No, absolutely. And just as a quick aside as well, I think one of the things that Governor Abbott here in Texas did that will be looked on in terms of what was one of the big propellers for President Trump to be reelected was the sending of folks from El Paso and other cities along Texas to different cities around the country, and that perceived chaos, whether or not it was entirely real, whether or not it was perpetuated by right-wing media, it certainly led to a lot of people in El Paso and in the interior of the country too, feeling that the situation was out of control. So I think there's a lot to that there, and that's happened in the past, and I feel like that's a tale as old as time. I wanted to switch, but not too much, in terms of immigration and another inflection point that, at least for me, my dad, he had a casa de cambio, or an exchange house. So it's where you go and buy and sell dollars or pesos if you're visiting Juarez, or if you're going to make a trip to El Paso, you go buy the currency of the country. So he had one for many years, and he opened it in the mid-90s, I believe it was 1994.
Understandably so, but of course the major concern is human loss. I mean, do you know if there were many people in the building?
Oh, another one just hit. Something else just hit. A very large plane just flew directly over my building, and there's been another collision. Can you see it? I can see it on the shot.
Oh my God. And then 9/11 happens. And that, I mean, even for me personally, that changed my own life dramatically, because back then my dad would travel to Juarez from El Paso every day and then come back and cross the border every single night, and sometimes getting back at 8 or 9 p.m. And after 9/11, when the lines to cross back into the U.S. became just 3, 4, 5 hours, he had to make the choice of staying in Juarez for 3 or 4 days out of the week and then coming back to El Paso on the weekends. And I'm sure for a lot of families, that was probably true, where you had to make tough choices in terms of, if your kids live in Juarez, but they go to school in El Paso, does that mean that they have to move there full time? Because crossing the border every single day became something that was really not possible for a lot of folks. And I feel like the repercussions of the 9/11 enforcement machine, even though none of the terrorists who attacked New York City and Washington on that day crossed through the southern border or crossed through El Paso, just the impact, I think, is something that is still felt to this day. So I'm not sure if you're able to recall not necessarily the events of that day, but just kind of the sentiment. I was in high school. It felt like things were falling apart around me. I was at Eastwood. And, you know, I'm sure covering it was a very different experience and seeing what the response was along the border. Our life on the border changed dramatically after 9/11.
Yeah, I think, among other things, they actually physically closed the border that day, which I believe was the first time that had happened since President Kennedy was assassinated back in 1963. So there was a lot of, again, fear, anxiety. We didn't know what was happening. You know, I think one of the things that's led this country astray is we have these attackers who are mostly from Saudi Arabia, who overstayed visas, came into the country, and totally upended our society. The United States decided to turn its focus to two things in response to that. One was to Iraq, which was not involved in 9/11, and to the U.S.-Mexico border, which was also not involved in 9/11. It just upended things. And then just on a human scale, the one thing I remember vividly is the Halloween immediately after 9/11. So September, this attack happens. The following October, as anybody who's been here for any length of time knows, one of the beautiful things about El Paso Halloween is you have this influx of kids coming over from Mexico, engaging in this very American experience. It's super cool. It's such a great expression of our cultures. That worked really well when people could move back and forth. But on Halloween of 2001, this family had come across in an old pickup truck with a camper shell, taken their kids trick-or-treating, and then went back. And there's a long line waiting to come across. And so the truck idled for a couple of hours on the bridge trying to cross, and the bed of the pickup was rusted, and you had exhaust seeping into the bed of the pickup, which is protected by a camper shell. And unbeknownst to the parents, the kids in the back were suffocated by carbon monoxide poisoning. I mean, that's just kind of a small human tale, what a change like that means. And I think, you know, from a big picture standpoint, when I first came to El Paso in 1986, people would always tell me that El Paso and Juarez were one community. And I think it was largely true. I think it has become less and less true since 9/11, just because it's so difficult to move back and forth. But just how we interact as neighbors and as families has just changed dramatically since 9/11.
No, I agree wholeheartedly with that sentiment. And I think back to just how much our lives changed that day, just for us personally, as I mentioned. It's hard to remember what it was like before then. I do remember going to visit my dad at his business, and I had a great aunt of mine who lived in Juarez, and my mom loved her dearly. And we would go frequently. We would go once, twice every month. My dad would go there every day. So it did feel very much like it was one community. And I think it's just slowly deteriorated over time. And I think there have been efforts, especially more so lately, of trying to reconnect or rekindle that connection that both cities have had. But I know it's an uphill battle, especially, as you mentioned, given the violence that really broke out in the early 2010s in Juarez too, which we can talk about if you had to cover that, because I'm sure that was very difficult to see as well, seeing our sister city suffer as much as it did.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. With Shopify, 2026 is the year you make it happen. It gives you the tools to build your dream store, online and in person. Plus, with marketing built in, it'll help you reach exactly who you need to. Join the millions who've already made the leap, like Gymshark and Allbirds. And ring in the new year with Shopify. Sign up for your £1 per month trial at shopify.co.uk/Spotify.
Continuing on the theme of El Paso through the lens of immigration, I know that you've reported on the city for a very long time, but it always feels like, to an outsider's perspective, El Paso is a desert town that really only makes the news in relation to its proximity to Mexico and therefore its proximity for people who want to get to the U.S. But what are those things that have changed over time in the immigration discourse? And what are some of those that remain the same or maybe now even become exacerbated over the last, especially 10 or 12 years?
Going back to Operation Hold the Line, it's important to note that all of the activities that Sylvester Reyes put into place were all really built around one thing, and that's to stop single Mexican men from coming across and seeking work in the United States. That's what immigration was back in that era and really up to 9/11. The idea of permanently relocating families into the United States as a form of unauthorized immigration, at least, was just not something we saw a lot. But that began to change over time, first with Mexicans. So post 9/11, one of the consequences of hardening the border and making it more difficult to cross is that workers couldn't count on being able to cross multiple times. So once they crossed, they needed to be prepared to stay here as long as they needed to in order to raise the money or whatever they were trying to do. That also increasingly meant that you had Mexican families that were beginning to cross more, not just single Mexican men. But all along, our immigration enforcement system was still really set up to stop single men. And that continued really up until the last couple of years and still continues in many ways. And so, you know, depending on the economy and people's anxieties and things like that, immigration focus in the United States kind of waxes and wanes all the time. So, you know, going to the election of Barack Obama in 2008, that's obviously accompanied by the worst economic collapse since the Great Depression. So people are losing jobs. Whenever that happens, people start to turn their focus toward immigrants and like, why are we allowing them to cross? And so Obama then gets this moniker that I think he always hated. He gets the name Deporter in Chief because he really ramps up deportation exercises.
Undocumented workers broke our immigration laws, and I believe that they must be held accountable, especially those who may be dangerous. That's why over the past 6 years, deportations of criminals are up 80%. And that's why we're going to keep focusing enforcement resources on actual threats to our security.
What had also happened in that transition from Obama to Trump, the number of crossers began to decline in the second half of Obama's term in those last 4 years. And really, we had Border Patrol agents who, on average, were making 2 apprehensions a month at one point. That had slowed down. But what began to change in 2014 and then really began to ramp up after that. So 2014, Obama's still president, and you have the first influx of families coming from Central America and beginning to use the asylum system.
And a lot of unaccompanied minors as well.
Unaccompanied minors. So the parents often came first, and then they send for their kids later. And so that's when you have the first imagery of kids in cages. A lot of people have forgotten this, but that was actually during the Obama administration. I've had the opportunity to interview a lot of the people who worked for Obama in the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which handled unaccompanied kids. And they talk quite extensively about the mistakes they made. And they actually put in a pretty good playbook after that, that the Trump administration followed at times and then didn't follow at times. So you initially have, starting in 2014, this surge of immigration from what's known as the Northern Triangle of Central America, Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. Lots of families, lots of unaccompanied kids, but they're all still being interdicted by a Border Patrol system that is set up to handle single men. There are struggles to house these people temporarily while they're being processed. And it's this mess that begins to get created. One of the few things that was actually working during all this time was this volunteer network here in El Paso. The Annunciation House chain of shelters or hospitality centers, as Ruben Garcia would call them, they built a very efficient system of being able to take migrant families out of Border Patrol custody, house them temporarily here, and then quickly connect them with families or other sponsors in the interior of the country. But the government continued to struggle with how to deal with it. At the end of the Obama administration, the numbers had started to come down a little bit. And then Trump takes over and they're low initially because of Trump's rhetoric. But then the smuggling networks get much more sophisticated. And then you really have even larger migration efforts that begin to take shape. And, you know, Trump would talk a lot about caravans and things like that. The caravans always broke up in southern Mexico and never really made it to the border. What really made a difference is the smuggling networks managed to build this system of buses that could quickly run people from southern Mexico up to the border instead of people having to walk and hitchhike across the country, which had happened previously. You have the organized crime networks in Central America that are taking advantage of this. And the system begins to buckle here, and Trump begins to politicize it more and more as he goes on. And so in 2017, his first year in office, the Border Patrol in El Paso had sort of quietly pilot tested this program again as part of their consequence delivery regime to try to deter people from crossing in the first place. They begin to take children away from their parents when families are apprehended together. Some activists got wind of this very early on and were trying to raise attention. Mike Torres, who's a federal magistrate over at the federal courthouse, also began to hear this with some of the arrested parents who were talking, who were in his court and telling him, where are my kids? So they started to put that together. But then the Trump administration kind of shut down that pilot program for a couple months. But then in the spring of 2018, began to roll it out nationally with horrific results. And it was so bad that the Trump administration had to back off real quickly in the summer of 2018 and kind of unravel it. But then they realized, oh, they really hadn't kept good records and they really didn't know which kids tied to what parents and where those kids were and where the parents were. It was just a fiasco. And I had left the El Paso Times by this point because I was tired of laying people off. So I was working as a freelance reporter, mostly for the Washington Post and Texas Monthly. And I wound up kind of with a front row seat to a lot of these family separation issues. And because I'd built some trust with Ruben Garcia at Annunciation House and some others, I was able to be present for some of the reunifications when they started happening in late June and then July of 2018. And I have to tell you, that is like some of the most horrific things I've ever been through. People will say, oh, it must have been so nice that when the kids finally saw their parents again, they must have been so happy. And I have to tell them, no, they thought their parents had abandoned them. The damage that our government did to those families for no real purpose other than try to scare the bejesus out of other people in Central America is one of the most shameful events I've ever seen in our country's history.
It's almost impossible to fathom that there's anything that anyone from the advocacy space or anyone who is against the administration, that they would change their tune given who they have running immigration enforcement with the likes of Stephen Miller. And yes, I remember that so vividly. I was already working in immigration enforcement, and just the horrors, the stories, the audio, I'm sure you remember clearly.
That was what put an end to it, because hearing a baby crying for minutes upon minutes and listening to a Border Patrol agent mocking the baby for crying, I mean, that was too much. I shudder to think what might have happened if that audio hadn't come out.
Right.
That was a difference maker. But yeah, I think here we are only 7 years later. I doubt that kind of public outrage would move the Trump administration to reverse course. They've become much more hardened against even showing signs, what they view as signs of weakness, by switching course in the face of public outrage.
No, absolutely. I agree wholeheartedly. And I mean, I think what you've seen in places like Chicago and Charlotte and other cities, Trump's going so far as to say that he feels that they're not going far enough. I think it shows us the dramatic change in how they view it even 7-8 years later. I'm glad you brought up Rubén García of Annunciation House. He's one of many local folks who have really gone above and beyond in terms of trying to welcome people to the city. Them, along with Las Américas, along with Estrella del Paso. There are so many folks who are dedicated, and even those who don't work for nonprofits, that want to ensure that El Paso continues to be a welcoming place, and who also want to continue the fabric of the community that has been built over decades here. And I even include the work that you do at El Paso Matters as wanting to ensure that the community is informed of what's happening. And honestly, I think El Paso Matters is one of the best things that's happened to the city. So I really want to commend you for that. I want to talk a little bit about that welcoming notion, that welcoming community that we've built. And I think we'd be remiss to not bring up what happened on August 3rd, 2019 here in El Paso. I wasn't living here at the moment. I was still living in Austin. I hadn't moved back yet, but I just remember texts and messages. And back then when I was still on Twitter and when it was still called Twitter, just seeing everything unfold. And obviously there was not a lot of information early on in terms of what was happening. But I think that fabric that we had worked so hard as a city and a community to build up was attempted to be destroyed in just one day and one Saturday afternoon.
So first, it's important to center it in the conversation we were just having. To summer 2019 was right in the midst of all of these Trump administration activities to basically dehumanize migrants and dehumanize population segments to score political points. This is when you first begin to hear immigration described as an invasion. And at that time, the language was really sort of restricted to the right-wing fever swamps of the internet. But unfortunately, there was a mentally disturbed young man in North Texas who gets caught up in that online fever swamp, becomes radicalized online, and decides on the night of August 2nd, 2019, that he's going to drive across the state to make a statement about immigration. He drives for 10 hours. Around 8 o'clock in the morning on August 3rd, 2019, he finds himself at a Walmart in El Paso. It's not entirely clear that he was like trying to target a Walmart or some big gathering point from the beginning. The best indication I have is he just wanted to make a big statement somewhere, sort of by happenstance wound up at this Walmart at Sierra Vista Mall. If he'd wanted to, he couldn't have picked a larger gathering of people on a Saturday morning in El Paso, Mexican-Americans and Mexicans, because you had the influx of shoppers from Chihuahua coming over. It was packed, you know, more than 1,000 people inside the store. And he eventually, after an hour and a half or so, goes into the store armed with a Romanian-made assault rifle that he had bought on the internet a couple months earlier. Right before going into the store, he uploads what he calls a manifesto to 8chan, which is a congregating spot for the worst of the worst in the extremist world, says he's doing this to stop the Hispanic invasion of Texas. I've had the misfortune of seeing the video evidence of what happened. He kills one woman in the parking lot, starts shooting at a girls' soccer team that's raising money outside the store, goes into the store, kills a couple people going in, then goes to a bank that was inside the Walmart in this kind of very confined space and just opens fire on a bunch of people inside the bank. And at the end of all of this, 22 people had died within the first 24 hours of that shooting. Another man, a coach of the girls' soccer team, died about 9 months later. So all in all, 23 people were killed, 22 people wounded in what was the deadliest attack aimed at Hispanics in the nation's history. The deadliest attack of domestic terrorism since the Oklahoma City bombing in the 1990s, but all driven by this idea that people coming from Central and South America represented a threat to the United States.
I even remember Governor Abbott having sent out a flyer or some sort of pamphlet just the day before, saying, essentially urging Texans to take it upon themselves to stop the invasion of migrants. So I remember there was a lot of backtracking shortly after the shooting. There was a lot of promises, making sure that their language isn't deemed as part of the problem at radicalizing. I think that has long been forgotten now. This many years later, I don't necessarily think that they care to police their language too much on how they talk about immigrants, especially when they're being led by Donald Trump. So I appreciate you walking us through that horrible, horrible day through the eyes of a journalist. Obviously, what happened that day became national news immediately.
I was out there real quick. I was working for the Washington Post at the time, and that manifesto surfaced very, very quickly. So it was very evident within the first couple of hours of the shooting what the motivation was. We didn't have quite the picture on how bad this was. I ran into Jaime Esparza, who was the district attorney at the time, later that afternoon. And I just said, how bad? And he just, and I didn't realize this, his sister was in the store and had survived. And he just looked at me and said, it's really, really bad. And it was later that afternoon that we got a more complete picture. But almost from the get-go, there was this well-established nexus to white supremacist terror.
Yeah, and I think to paint the picture in terms of the location of this Walmart for folks who might not know, it's one that's so centrally located that you can be in Juarez within 10 minutes of leaving that Walmart. It is so close to the border. It is right next to our major shopping mall in the city. And I just remember from afar, this sense, and I don't know if it was right or not, I still don't know, but it almost felt to me immediately that there's no way that someone from El Paso would be capable of doing something like this. And of course, it's possible, given the nature of our country, any of that is possible. But just how everything happened, and especially once it became clear what the motivations were, it just felt almost surreal to see it happen. And I wonder, from your perspective, having covered the city for so long, what role, or if any, did you take in terms of the coverage after to make sure that folks who were coming in from national outlets, who didn't know the city very well, what did you want to make sure that folks took away from El Paso, because it became such a mark for our city in terms of what people knew about us? So given the fact that you had worked here, there was going to be a lot of reporters parachuting in, trying to tell the story, making sure that they told it well. I think everyone did as good a job as they could with the information that they had. But was there anything that you were hoping that the national narrative could become after the shooting?
The one thing I wanted was for this not to just be labeled, the latest mass shooting. Again, that's another unfortunate part of where we are as a country right now. These things have become very, very commonplace, especially in Texas. It was complicated on August 3rd by the fact that there was another mass shooting that night in Dayton, Ohio, kind of got conflated for a while. So I was on CNN at one point and really trying to drive home this point. This is not just a mass shooting. This is an act of hate, an act of domestic terrorism, and we have to treat it as such. And I was also trying to inform people as best I could about what a welcoming community El Paso is. And I think the media saw that in the various gatherings that we had. The one big national story I got while I was covering this is I'd gotten a tip that when President Trump, who came out here against the wishes of virtually the entire leadership of the community, went to University Medical Center, he asked to meet with the families of the survivors who were still hospitalized there. And to a person, they all said no. And I had a source who kind of leaked that information to me. University Medical Center, to its credit, they could have kind of ducked the question. They confirmed it for me. And that was a powerful moment, I think, for El Paso, and a very embarrassing moment for the president. It was also later that day or the next day that the picture came out of the president and first lady holding up this one-year-old child whose parents had been killed in the attack, and the child was injured when his dying mother fell on him. And the first lady is holding the baby, and the president has just got this goofy grin with a thumbs up. That image is still burned in my mind as just kind of a summary of kind of his thinking and how he viewed the shooting. But the other thing I knew about the media reaction is that they were going to go. I mean, we had maybe a week at the most that we would be in the spotlight, and then other news would take place. And I knew that we in El Paso, not just the media, but the entire community, would be dealing with the consequences of this for years to come. And I wanted to make sure that we didn't lose sight of that. So I started El Paso Matters in 2020. We started publishing about 7 months after the shooting. And I've kind of made a promise to myself that I would continue to follow up on all of this as long as I could, to get the best understanding we can to the world about what happened here and why that still matters. And so I've been to every court hearing. I was present at both the federal and state sentencing. I've gotten to be close to some of the families who have been re-traumatized by the system over the years.
No, and honestly, and I say this sincerely, in terms of coverage of the shooting and its aftermath, I don't believe anyone has done the work that you have at El Paso Matters and your team have done and led in terms of folks understanding all of the ins and outs of the hearings and of the trials. And I know there's one story in particular that just hit me so hard as an El Pasoan from April 22nd of this year, of when two of the victims who had lost family members in the shooting had chosen and asked the judge if they could hug the shooter. And yeah, I get choked up even just thinking about it, Bob, but I'm wondering, that was almost like the culmination, right, of almost 6 years of coverage of such a heinous act. And it almost wraps up entirely with two El Pasoans wanting to show compassion. And I don't want to speak to what their motivations were or what they might have been thinking. But I'm just curious, as you reported that story, and I encourage folks to go and read it, what you got out of it from Yolanda and Adriana wanting to hug the shooter.
So it's important to note, again, for the context that we've been talking about here of how our El Paso and Juarez are linked. One of the women was from El Paso and one was from Juarez. The woman from El Paso had lost her brother. The woman from Juarez had lost her husband. And I just thought it was such a beautiful expression of El Paso. And Yolanda's speech, you know, as she's kind of leading up to this, was really powerful because she's talking to Crucius, the gunman, and just saying, if you had just come to talk to us, we would have given you a Mexican meal. You would have realized that all of this that you've come to believe isn't true. And it's just so powerful. And she, you know, expressed forgiveness. And frankly, when she mentioned that she'd like to hug him, I kind of missed it at first. It just went by because I was kind of tied up with the other things she was saying. But Judge San Medrano had picked up on that real quickly. And so when she finished and she was going to, her daughter was with her and she's going to turn it over to her daughter to give the next victim impact statement. And Judge Medrano stopped her and said, just a second, ma'am. You said it would make you feel better if you hugged him, but you know that's not allowed. And she said, yeah, yes, Your Honor. And he said, go ahead. And so this came out of nowhere. And it shocked the hell out of the defense team. Sure as hell shocked Patrick Crucius, and I was kind of watching him very carefully as this beautiful woman walks across the courtroom, assisted by this massive security presence that was really there for no other reason than to keep the victims' families away from this guy. And so they take her over, and she reaches her arms around him and says something. And he's handcuffed, and so he doesn't know what to do with his hands, and it's very, very awkward. And he's very socially awkward to begin with. But I could tell on his face he was not at all pleased with what was happening. And I looked up at the judge, and he had turned his head away and was just sobbing. And then I hear sobbing all around me. Shit, I'm crying too.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
This really, really powerful summary of what the border is. This welcoming community, even to the point of willing to forgive somebody who has inflicted more damage than you can imagine. But, you know, I talked to some experts on forgiveness after this because I'm trying to make sense of it and I can't. And one of the things that I learned was that the act of forgiveness removed whatever shred of power he had over these families. They just basically said, you're not part of our lives now. You're done. We're moving on. So it's not just this very Christian act, which it was for both of these women, but it's also a very powerful act of saying, I am in control of my life. I know who I am. I know who we are as a community. You don't get to define us. You don't get to control us. And that was just such a powerful way to close that chapter in our lives. And I think in some ways allowed the community to start moving forward a lot more. Obviously, the political rhetoric around this has just gotten more intense, as you've mentioned. So it's not like anti-immigrant sentiment ended because these two wonderful women who live in our community spoke out. It's still there. But I think they've just given a powerful witness to who we are as a community. And that's what I love to focus on.
Thank you for sharing that, Bob. It's incredible to hear it from your perspective beyond the reporting on your piece and you being there in person witnessing it. I just can't imagine the impact that it had on you and those who were around you as well. And my final question, now that we've navigated as best we could about 40 or so years of history of our beloved border town, is not only what happened on August 3rd, 2019, but the thread that we've been trying to weave on our conversation. What do you think is El Paso's understanding of itself at this moment now in 2025?
It's changing. I think the shooting had a deep impact on us. But at the same time, I think some of the chaotic scenes that we all saw in 2022 and 2023, when you had this large migration from South America up to here, largely of Venezuelans, and you had for the first time people sleeping out on the streets in El Paso, I think that kind of reframed the thinking for some people and started to test the welcoming nature of the community. And that then plays out in the election of 2024, where Trump won a number of border communities. He did not win El Paso. He only got 42% of the vote, but that was significantly above what he had received in both 2016 and 2020. And other Republican candidates on the ballot in El Paso fared better than they typically had. So I think that was just a reminder that people of border communities are complex people. They have differing viewpoints on a lot of things. Nobody should take them for granted politically. Ironically, I think in some ways Trump and the Republicans are taking them for granted now, just as Democrats took them for granted before. So hopefully the 2024 election results serve as a wake-up call to both parties that to win the votes, you need to work for it. And I think kind of a reminder to Democrats that people don't like broken systems, and this is not to put the blame on Democrats for the immigration system being broken. There have been a lot of chefs in that kitchen over the years, but you know, people run out of patience after a while. And so we've got a lot of work to do as a country. The people of the border are great models for what the country should look like, and hopefully we can continue to be that. I love living on the border. I love the people here. We have our problems. I'm not denying that. We have our challenges. But this is a great place to be. And I wish more people understood that.
That's exactly right. And I wish people would take the time to come visit us and see for themselves what a beautiful place our borderland can be. Thank you so much, Bob Moore, President and CEO of El Paso Matters, not only for your time today, but also for the work that you've been leading now for so many years. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks for talking with me.
And that was Bob Moore, president and founder of El Paso Matters, an independent publication here in our border region. I highly encourage you to give them a follow if you want to stay up to date on what's happening both in El Paso and in Juarez. Special thanks to Bob. He was one of the first people that I thought of to interview for this Borderly project, so I'm incredibly thankful for his time and his coverage of our city. I know it got heavy there at the end of our conversation, talking about the El Paso shooting on August 3rd, 2019, but I hope that that final story that we shared of the two victims who lost loved ones on that day, but still had the humanity within them to want to hug as a way for them to forgive what happened that day, and also for closure, wanting to hug the shooter. I hope that shows just how much humanity exists on our border, and it shows a true representation of what it means to be both from El Paso and from Juarez. So thank you again to Bob for sharing that and for sharing much of his own personal story and professional career as he's covered our region now for decades. And again, this was Borderly, a project of Immigrantly, hosted by me, Mario Carrillo, produced by Sadia Khan, editorial review by Shay Yu, sound design, theme music, and editing by Lou Raskin, and other music by Epidemic Sound. I hope you enjoyed. Please leave a review, and we'll catch you next time.